intended to the home. Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think the specific maintenance area, given many times, I will really limit it to the minimum of time. Chairperson, the list of proclamations that have been tabled for the attention of the committee is on the presentation, which is on the screen there. Chair, it is once again quite a long list, but we have tabled them as they were made available. But once they are presented to Parliament, it's, they come together, so it's maybe a bit longer than we would have preferred. Chair, there really is nothing new in the sense that South Africa will really become involved if a citizen or a person in the Republic is being listed. So far, since the listing started, there's only one person that is living in South Africa that has been listed, and as you know, there were other attempts to list people which were not successful. So, Chair, amongst the proclamations that we have tabled to the committee, there are no persons living in South Africa or South Africans which are affected by the list. Chair, you will also notice if one would go through the proclamations that it's not only listing, but it's any amendment to the list. So there's, you will see that recently there has quite been a number of people who have been removed from the list, and that is as a result of the fact that the UN Security Council itself have improved the processes in terms of listing, as well as the delisting of persons who are not suspected anymore, as well as people who have died in the meantime and who are removed from the list. Chair, I don't know if there's a need from the committee. I can mention just for example that about a week ago, 2 weeks ago, the United Nations Security Council approved new guidelines in terms of their processes. If there's a need in future that we must address the committee on issues like that, I think we can do it. But for the present, it really is the same presentation we used the previous times, and there's nothing that I think specifically needs the attention of the committee rather than to note the issues and the proclamations that have been published. Thank you, Chair.
Members, there you have the presentation, short and sweet. Is there anything that members would like to ask in terms of clarity at this point in time?
Not now.
Honourable Olubachi, you're fine. Thank you very much. We did say, and I think that it's starting to help us, that we want these proclamations on a more regular basis, that we don't deal with stacks and stacks of proclamations at a time. So can we also ask the department to alert us if you feel there is, in the near future, a reason for us to meet again on this, so we can actually have a look at it. Members, are you satisfied? Can we see that it's been dealt with?
Yes.
Thank you very much. We will then immediately go over to the second part of the meeting, which is the presentation by the committee's researchers on the DNA legislation. Colette?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Good morning, members and members of the public. I'm just going to give a broad overview of the DNA Amendment Bill as was tabled in Parliament earlier this year. If we go to the introduction, members know that there is no legislative framework currently in play to deal with DNA evidence currently in South Africa. In 2009, the amendment bill was introduced to the third parliament, to the ad hoc committee on the criminal law forensic procedures amendment bill ad hoc committee. But due to time constraints, it was left over to the fourth parliament. In September 2009, the amendment bill was referred to the Portfolio Committee on Police, and the committee then took a decision to split the 2009 amendment vote into two parts. The first phase dealt with the fingerprints, body prints, and photographic evidence. And the second part would deal with DNA aspects and the establishment of a DNA database. During the 2009 amendable process, public hearings were held, and a variety of issues were raised during the public hearings in 2009. Most notably, it was relating to issues of privacy and human rights, and the lack of the implementation strategy by the department, and also capacity issues. There was also concerns around outsourcing of DNA analysis and the audit privatization of forensic analysis. After this, the committee decided to undertake an international study tour to Canada and the UK. This was done in June, July 2011. After the study tour, the committee published a report and just the selected issues that was mentioned in the report is a Bill of Rights issue pertaining to the Bill of Rights, the cost implication of the DNA database, and the lack of an oversized body. There's eight key changes to the 2013 version of the amendment bill. And the first one, and the allowance made for such and IFAD members to take bottle samples included in the definition of an authorized person. Intimate samples can now only be taken by a registered nurse or a medical practitioner. Bottle samples may be taken by an authorized person, i.e. VAS or IFAD, only after they receive the adequate training, and this must be taken in a designated area. If we look at offences where samples may be taken, now samples must be taken for the following, and this can be done without a warrant. On Schedule 1 offences, for a person whose name is on the register for sex offenders, and offenders currently serving sentences of imprisonment, unless the samples taken before release. Samples may be taken for the following without a warrant: for persons or groups suspected of Schedule 1 offences. Now, for this, consent is needed, and if consent is not given, then a warrant is needed to take the sample. And also, a sample may be taken for all other offences. The first key change is the retention of samples. Any crimes in samples may be retained indefinitely. If we look at the retention of profiles, profiles from a crime scene, the elimination and convicted persons of or offenders index can get indefinitely. The DNA profiles of on the arrestee index must be expunged within 3 years if there is no conviction. Profiles on the volunteer index must be expunged within 3 months of the case being finalized, or if the volunteer gave permission for retention of that sample, he or she must request in writing that the sample be expunged, and then this must be done within 3 months. For children, the samples or the DNA profiles must be expunged in terms of the Child Justice Act of 2008. The seventh key change is the removal of all reference to privately operated forensic laboratories. And the last major change is the establishment of a National Forensic Oversight Board. Now, the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill, commonly known as the DNA Bill, amends all main acts, clauses 1 to 5, amends the Criminal Law Procedure Act of 1977, clause 6, which is the insertion of chapter 5B into the South African Police Act of 1995, clause 7 to 8 amends the Firearms Control Act, and clauses 9 to 10 amend the Explosive Act of 2003. Members, Honourable Chairperson, if we go to Clause 1 and look at the definitions, we are now dealing with the Criminal Procedures Act of 1977. If we look at the authorised officer, as mentioned earlier, an authorised officer is a police officer commanding the division responsible for forensic services in the police service. An authorised person, as mentioned earlier, now includes staff and IPED members with a training or a medical practitioner or medical or registered nurse from the Department of Social Department of Correctional Services to take buccal samples, and members must remember that this excludes a crime scene examiner to take a buccal sample or any evidence as a crime scene. A bodily sample is defined as an intimate as well as a non-intimate sample, and a buccal sample is taken with a swab from inside a person's mouth. A comparative search is found as samples or profiles against DNA profiles stored in indexes by the authorized person. A crime scene sample is evidence retrieved from crime scene or any place where evidence is found and may include evidence collected from the body of a person. A forensic DNA profile results from DNA analysis or body samples from a person or crime scene and may and not contain any information on the health, medical or mental condition or physical information of the person from whom the sample was taken. The only information that can be sought with the sample or with the profile is the sex of the person. An intimate sample is now defined as a blood sample, and it now includes a blood finger prick, which members can remember was in the previous version was defined as a non-intimate sample. It also includes pubic hair or samples taken from the genitals or anal area of a person. A non-intimate sample includes a buccal sample, a nail sample, or sample taken from under the nail of a person. And as I said, a blood fingerprint is now defined as intimate sample. If you look further at Clause 1, and we look at the circumstances under which a sample can be taken, Clause 1G provides for the circumstances under which a bodily sample may be taken. A bodily sample may be taken with consent or a warrant or authorized under Section 36D, which is such Clause 2, or the arrested person on any offense, or in a correctional center or remand detainee center. The law further provides for vehicle samples that may only be taken by authorized person in a designated area and must be done in terms of the relevant national instruction or regulation issued. Intimate samples may only be taken by a medical practitioner or registered nurse, and special provision for samples taken from children made in Section 36A, Sub 2 of the Criminal Procedure Act in terms of privacy, parental consent, and the like. If we look at a summary of when samples may be taken, as mentioned in Section 1G, consent and warrant is basically needed in terms of Section 36E, where samples from a person or group of persons suspected of having committed a Schedule 1 offence but not arrested must be taken with consent. Now, if consent is not given, then a warrant is needed, and this is for cases which are still under investigation. Samples must be taken in terms of Section 36D from persons accused of a Schedule 1 offense if the name of the person appears on the National Register of Sex Offenders for incarcerated persons currently in prison where a sample was not taken at arrest. And these samples must be taken by a registered nurse or doctor in the employment of the Department of Correctional Services. For these incarcerated persons, the samples can be taken or must be taken without warrant or consent. If we look at the conditions under which samples may be taken, this is in section 36D.2. It's basically the person accused of any offence.
So we stop here after clause 1. Can I ask whether there's any questions of clarity at this age so that we can deal with it, I think, under the different clauses. Otherwise, we might get confused ourselves. Honourable Kudabarna, anybody else? Honourable Chairman?
Thank you, Chair. Just two issues of clarity here. I didn't read it, perhaps I missed it, but I did hear reference to a correctional service officer being included as the one of the authorized personnel to take the sample. Obviously, we had determined that those incarcerated need to have buccal sample taken as a matter of course. Does it include the correctional service people, or are we relying on the SAPs to go in, which may indeed be rather onerous for the SAPs? Secondly, your definition of the intimate sample. Now, that refers to genitals. I'm not sure of the exact definition, but I would imagine that actually excludes women's breasts. Please could we look at that definition? We may have to extend that, because I think that should be absolutely clear that cannot be forced upon one. That's all I have for the moment. Thank you.
Honourable Two.
Thanks, Chairperson. My question is on slide 6 also, but it's a clarity-seeking one. The reference to the Department of Correctional Services as the authorized people or person. What I'd like to find out is that these people, are they already been convicted? Are we referring to people who are already been convicted? That's my question, because if I believe they have been convicted already, they have been convicted based on certain evidence. So that's what I want to find out. What the root of the correctional services here? Thanks.
Yeah, I'm going to ask the department to assist if necessary in the question. Honourable George.
Well, Ed, would you mind?
After 20 years, you still need to remind you to put his microphone on.
No, but I've been paying him to do this thing all along. Now I think he's on strike. Constant sample. Can I get explanation on the last? Is evidence retrieved from crimes, you know, any place where evidence is found and may include evidence collected from body of a person? What does this mean? Because talking about a person who's found in a crime scene or talking about a person who suspected during this, he is met in his house or home.
Can you please?
Thank you, Honourable Minister. Referring to Honourable Kalabana's question, the reference to the Department of Correctional Services, the samples are only being taken by a registered nurse or doctor in the employment of the correctional services. So it's not to include correctional personnel. Also regarding the intimate samples, the amendment bill does not specifically refer to a woman's breast, but the reference made in the CPA towards the fact that only that male officers cannot do any bodily search on a female suspect. So the committee can give further deliberation on that to make more clear within the amendment act. If we go to Honourable Machumi, the reference made to the Department of Correctional Services here is that if prisoners currently serving a sentence in prison, the sample were not taken when they were arrested, if that's now before the fact, will come into operation. And Mr. George, Honourable George, apologies. A crime scene sample, that is basically if semen or things like evidence found on the victim's body or clothes, that will be included in a crime scene sample. And that's all the victim's blood on the suspected perpetrator's clothes or at the scene. I hope that is...
There's
still a chair in this meeting, and we're not having a dialogue between the Honourable George and Nicolette. General Sandy, you raised your hand. Is there somebody from the Secretary that wants to add something as well? If you want to, just indicate to me, please. General Sandy.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to add to Madam on the answer on the body, definition of the body, or in instances where a sample is taken from a body. Normally in crime investigation, you do not refer to a live person as a body. If there is a murder case, for instance, and a person is found laying on the scene, the person is assumed to be dead. Let's assume the person is dead. That will be a body. So when the investigating officers are on the scene, you may not want the body to be removed from the scene before you have collected the sample. In that instance, that body is a crime scene itself. So you may be able to collect a sample from the body. Of course, you are not going to go intimate in that instance as well. So there are instances where, like she already said, there may have been the ejaculation on the body, that you see the body stains. There may be clothes that you may remove or from the body of a person laying there. That is a sample that you, the investigator of the crime scene may remove, you know, for evidence purposes. So it can happen. It happens. In fact, it happens a lot.
Everybody satisfied? Can we continue with clause two? Continue, please, Mr.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just quickly also want to point attention towards Honourable Mitchell's question. There's also reference made in the amendment bill towards detainees in a remand centre. That these people, samples must also be taken off them. That is a bit of a a point on which the committee can further deliberate, but these people have not yet been convicted. They're only in a remand center, but samples also must be taken off them according to their current amendment. If we look at clause 2, it speaks with the powers in respect of samples. Clause 2 in section 36B and 36E in the Criminal Procedures Act. Subsection 36D1 lists the categories of offences in respect of which a bodily sample must be taken without consent or a warrant. These are persons arrested under Schedule 1 offences, persons released on bail on a Schedule 1 offence if a sample was not taken upon arrest, a person upon whom a summons has been served in terms of Schedule 1 offence, a person listed on the National Register of Sex Offenders, and for any offence, Schedule by the Minister in the Government Gazette. Subsection 36D2 expands further the mandate further to allow the samples may be taken at the discretion of an authorised person, which is upper of sex offenders, in terms of the above, but with respect to all offences. These are not limited to Schedule 1 offences, and that's also not subject to consent given or a warrant. And subsection 36D3 deals with the forwarding of samples to a forensic laboratory, and says that samples must be forwarded to the relevant laboratory immediately. Subsection 36B4 deals with the retaking of samples if they are not suitable or if they are insufficient for DNA analysis. Subsection 36D5 allows for the subjecting of profiles to a comparative search. Subsection 36E6 provides a limitation upon the use of such profiles. Profiles can only be used for the detection of crime, for the investigation of a crime, for conducting of a prosecution, identification of unidentified human remains, and the identification of a missing person. Section 36E deals with samples for investigative purposes. Suspect samples may be taken on reasonable grounds when suspect, a person, or group of persons having committed a Schedule 1 offense and where they believe that the sample can help to include or exclude persons as suspects. Consent in this section is needed. If not given, then the officer must get a warrant for the sample to be taken. Now, members must just bear in mind that this section speaks specifically to suspects and not yet arrested.
Any questions on this section? Honourable Kula Barnett, Honourable Mulabatsi, Honourable Sidia, Honourable Ntumi, Honourable George, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. It is highly detailed in who may take samples and under what circumstances and from whom. However, I don't see anywhere here the procedure should the person simply refuse, even if you have a warrant and they refuse. You can't hold a person down and force their mouth open. I know when we were overseas, they said if that was the case and the person refused to allow the officer access with the swab, they would say, well, I'm then going to pull some hair out of your head. And that usually ensured they opened their mouth very quickly. But I think that has to be detailed because we may find officers who feel they now have the right to hold someone down and force their mouth open, and that could be lead to a whole other issues. So if it's just detailed what powers are allowed, or the process, perhaps, and I don't see that anywhere. Thank you.
And I ask members to keep your questions to questions of clarity. We will argue the points at a later stage, so just keep your questions to questions of clarity, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the retaking of samples, will it be as good as the first one? Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Chun.
It's almost the same question, Chairperson, but asked differently. After how long would then be considered that this sample is not enough, that there's a need to do a retake of the DNA?
Honourable George.
Madam Chair, this is the area which previously was a bone of contention because it tampers with the rights of individuals. Now, I see a person upon whom a summons has been served. Where does it put us in terms of innocent until proven guilty? I mean, this person is a summons. What if this person refuses, and even refuses even when there's a warrant?
Honourable Global.
Jefferson, if Nicola can explain paragraph, the first paragraph on page 11, what does it mean? What does the paragraph mean?
I also have a question of clarity. I want to find out in terms of the movement of the samples taken to the laboratories. What does it say? What is that saying around that? My concern around this issue is the fact that we know that at police stations we often find evidence that should have gone to laboratories that have not gone to laboratories. So what are we putting in place in order to make sure that happens?
So sorry, Chair, it doesn't refer anywhere in here to a voluntary giving of a buccal sample, allowing an individual to take the swab and do it themselves, which I think many people would be far more comfortable with. It would seem to be less intrusive and may ensure an easier compliance. I didn't find it anywhere. Perhaps Nicola could point me to that section if in fact that does exist. Thank you.
Again, same ruling. If anybody from the department secretariat wants to add, please feel free to do so. Nicolette, over to you.
Thank you, Justin. I'm first from the beginning. I will kind of bottom up question regarding the procedure for food sample. It's not stated specifically in the amendment bill, but maybe the department can further explain that. And regarding the and regarding the self-taking of samples that were also not included in the amendment bill, and maybe also adopted by the department. Going to the question of Honourable Molobasi, and I think I'm almost in the global question type into this. So retaking of samples is provided for if a sample was taken from a suspect or a victim that was insufficient or not analyzed correctly. So the bill does make provision for that. I am not sure, but maybe the department can clarify, but this is not relating to a quarantine sample, which cannot be retaken. It's basically just the DNA sample of an actual person that remains constant and the same. So those can be retaken like a bottle swab or a more intimate sample. I hope that clarifies it. And on the chairperson's question, there is not a lot said in the amendment bill regarding the transportation of samples to and from or between laboratories and police stations, and the committee can further engage on that. Thank you.
Department ending. Honourable Chumi's question was similar to the Honourable
but you there's a given period that this should be done in the period of time. For instance, Nicolette mentioned that the reference has been made to the person has been raped, and how do you go back then and take that that sample? After how long?
I think before members decide that the question has not been answered, they must wait for the department and the secretariat if they want to add something, because as Nicolette has indicated, they have more detail in terms of the answer. So I think Commissioner Shays is going to attempt to answer that part of it. So just hang on and hear where the answer comes. If not, I'll come back to you again.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Chair. I'm going to answer the three questions in one, particularly referring to the 64. Retaking of samples if they are not suitable. This is in instances where a buccal sample is taken, honorable Bobby. It is not in incidence of a crime sample. You may not retake a crime sample. Well, you can retake a crime sample, but this provision is not for crime samples. Because once a crime scene examiner is in the scene, it is expected of the examiner to collect all the samples, because the samples are not safeguarded for an intensive purpose. At some point in time, the area must be declared free. So samples will be collected from the campuses. Those will be preserved. They will go through the lab. But this is referring specifically to the buccal samples in instances where there is no profile that is enough. It depends. One of the questions that was asked the previous time when you were here, how are we guaranteed that the people will take their correct samples? The police officers or the authorized person who's taking the sample. It can happen that not enough epithelials or cells that are in the cheeks are taken forth, which one gives the breadth profile or the length of the profile that you would want to make a comparison with. In those instances, we had made provisions that the samples may be retaken so that you get enough of those. After how long? There are internal processes to say how long does a sample take to process within the laboratory. Let's assume the sample is taken from me today, send it in the lab. There are processes involved in their current turnaround time is 28 working days. Within that days, there should be a result already. If there is no result for that particular sample, the sample must already be sent forth for retaking. So that will be also properly managed in terms of our processes. Of course, for the reference sample, the turnaround may be shorter, but it is a turnaround that we have currently in the processes. So yes, retaking of samples. It is samples for reference samples, background samples, not the crime scene samples. I should have answered all the three questions. Thanks, Jefferson.
Because I think we're clear on it. When we talk about the retake, we talk about of individuals, not the crime scene itself. I mean, I think that would be problematic if we have retaken of crime scenes. We'll also then open it up for abuse as well. Commissioner Jacobs?
Thank you, Chair. Just in relation to the question asked by Mrs. Diane Kolobana, in terms of the training, the Minister of Health has already prescribed the training that the person must receive in order to take a buccal sample. And I think if the person is allowed to take the buccal sample himself, it might actually affect the integrity of the test, because that person doesn't have the training that is required. So I think in terms of the integrity, it is better that a trained person actually be able to do that assignment.
Could you also, somebody from the department side, just respond for me in terms of the question about how do you intend taking or making sure samples get to the laboratory, please?
The time frame.
Thank you, Chairperson. For the time frame, they are not provided for in the Act itself, but amongst the other requirements following the bill is the compilation of the national instructions. In the national instructions in the draft that we have already compiled, which we haven't presented as yet because it's still under consultation, we have specified in there the period in which the samples should be taken from the collection of the sample to delivery of the samples at the lab. That does not only take about the period to transfer, but also the packaging, the storage conditions. I think these are other elements that were raised in the previous consultation, but they were not elevated to the level of bill, but rather the national instructions.
Now that immediately raising another question in my mind, knowing how SAPS may treat national instructions, should it not be elevated to the level of the bill? I'm just asking a question. And second to that, have you at any point in time considered making use of courier services to collect samples and take it to forensic laboratories from stations?
If I may respond to that one, during our consultation process with different departments, amongst other things that we had raised in that aspect was that the core functions of the police is to process the crime samples. But issues like transportation, issues like the packaging thereof, it may be something that we may consider, you know, to allow other entities to can provide that. So I would go into the deliberations of finalizing the national instructions, depending on how the outcome of the discussions will be, that will be taken on board. But until that is decided, it is still within the staff to ensure that those samples reach the lab, but until the finalization or the outcome of the discussions, we may then know to say this is the service that we may be able to provide.
Thanks, Chief. I think the point that you're raising is very valid as to whether the time frame should not elevate it to the Act, because the national instruction will solely remain applicable to the police. Now here we talk also of correctional services. So if it is in the Act, it equally binds the correctional services or other role players to be able to transport to the laboratories.
Honourable Kulabonis.
If I may follow up there, I understand obviously it's not your core function to be transporters of samples, but I believe there could be an element that may have to be fulfilled is guarding the transport. I mean, if I was a rapist or a murderer and my sources told me the samples were going to be transported, I would simply hold up the courier and destroy them, destroy the crime scene samples. So
I don't know that it's as simple as hiring a courier, unless the courier has private security with it. That may be an issue. I mean, well, it's all about crime. It's about rapes and murders and every crime in between. So I don't know that that doesn't need to be looked at security-wise quite carefully.
Honourable Quillip, honestly now, fully in the trap that I've just warned us about. I've asked this question specifically because it was an example that was given to us also in the UK of the courier, and that's why we need to consider it. I think when we come to the arguments around these things, we need to look at it. But I want to make clear that I do think we must mark this issue within the bill for proper discussion once we get to that point, but also in terms of the time frame. Commissioner Vaslani, with due respect, not only would it benefit because of other departments being involved, but definitely for SAPS as well. I visited Atlanta Police Station a few weeks ago, and that's an area where drugs and drug trafficking is very, very rife. And we found the drugs from 2008 that's never been sent to the Forensic Science Authority. So if we elevate this to a question of a time frame that is in the act, it also means the police officer not adhering to that is breaking the law, and there can be consequences for that. And then maybe we should look at the consequences for not delivering crime scene or battle shots within time. Continue, please.
Thank you, Joseph. If we look at clauses 3, 4, and 5, which also move the Criminal Procedure Act of 1977, clause 3 and in section 37 of the CPA, referring to the determination of distinguishable features and provide that police officials may not take an intimate sample, which was previously also including a blood sample. Clause 4, amend section 212 of the Criminal Procedure Act, provides for the collection of specimens. The amendment allows for affidavits on the issue around the collection of specimens, and not only for the receipt, custody, packing, delivery, or dispatch of the specimens. Clause 5 provides for the results of the analysis of evidence, taken from a body sample of the accused to be admissible as proceedings. Interestingly, the section provides for a sample not to be inadmissible at court, it is permissible, even if the sample was taken without consent or not in accordance with the provisioning of section 36A, B, C, D, and E, or section 37.
There's questions on this, on clause 3, 4, and 5. If I can kick off, I would like to ask this question to Mrs. Longo, who's here, from a justice point of view and a CPA perspective. Clause 5, the impact thereof in terms of prosecutions. I'm not that worried about the consent or not. I'm worried about in accordance with the provisions of the section. Why do we have the provisions of the section if we don't want, if we feel that once we get to court, those evidence, if it was not taken within the provisions of the section, can be inadmissible. Any other questions on the section? If that's the only one, can I ask Mr. Longer to respond to that one?
Sorry, thank you very much, Chair. Just to very briefly explain, I also apologize, I'm standing in for my colleague, Ms. Teresa Ross. Unfortunately, she's gotten her obligation. Chair, yes. I think this is consonant with the requirement, especially in the Constitution. When it comes to the right to a fair trial, this also affects the right to a fair trial. But I think the intention here is just to prevent a situation where an accused can be discharged on a mere technicality. So if there's an irregularity, the court will consider does that irregularity actually impact on the right to a fair trial. I think that is why the wording is used, not by reason only thereof that some other procedural standard has not been met. So it can well lead to a big problem for the prosecution, but the technical aspect will not by itself lead to that chair.
So from a judge's point of view, you're comfortable with this?
We're comfortable, thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. We now move on to clause 6 of the amendment bill, which inserts chapter 5B into the South African Police Service Act of 1995. This clause is rather comprehensive and provides for the establishment, administration and maintenance of the National Forensic DNA Database of South Africa. Many definitions in this clause is the same as in the CPA and will not be repeated. It is stated that the purpose of this chapter is to serve as a criminal investigative tool in the fight against crime, where applicable, identify persons that might have been involved in the commission of offences, including those committed before the chapter came into operation, to prove the innocence or guilt of accused persons, and to assist with the identification of missing or unidentified human remains. The third section is section 15G, and that deals with the establishment of a DNA database, which is called the National Forensic DNA Database of South Africa, and abbreviated as NFDD. The NFDD will be administered and maintained by the person in command of the Forensic Services Division of the South African Police Service. The DNA database will consist of five indexes, namely the Crime Scene Index, the Arrestee Index, the Offenders Index, the Volunteer Index, and the Elimination Index. Section 15G4 states that profile can be taken before the commencement of this Act can still be used for comparative purposes. Section 14G5 provides that indexes will not contain any information derived from a sample regarding the appearance of a person, the medical, historical, or behavioral information. The only information that may be kept on indexes is that of sex. If we look at section 15H, the Crime Scene Index, the bill states that this index will contain forensic DNA profiles derived from DNA analysis from bodily samples that are found and collected, including at a crime scene, at any place where an offence occurred while reasonably suspected of having been committed, on or in the body of a victim or suspect which was in contact with that person during the commission of an offence, or on anything worn or carried by the victim or suspect at the time when an offence was or is reasonably suspected of having been committed. In this basically, the Crime Scene Index will contain profiles of body substances left at crime scenes or taken from victims and suspects pertaining to a particular crime scene.
Can we deal with the Crime Scene Index then? Any questions on that, Honourable Kula Bonnet?
I see. In fact, just before that, refers to the volunteer and elimination indexes. I just wondered, are those specifically in relation to crime scenes, or is that also going to be considered at the laboratories? When we visited laboratories, they asked for DNA samples as elimination samples in case we somehow polluted their samples through the air. I don't know how it would happen. So we gave those. Now, is that what will be included under here, or is this only a crime scene matter? Or will that even be considered?
Sorry, I might be confusing you, but I'm trying to do index by index, so we know what the Crime Scene Index. So is there any question on the Crime Scene Index specifically that members want to ask? Nothing? Okay, then we can move on to the next one.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to refer to Honourable Kalibana's question, the crime scene index will only contain samples taken from a crime scene.
Yeah. Apologies, I was going through the Act on looking at the previous chapter in the Act and not according to your notes, so I was specifically looking at those non-crime scene indexes. Thank you.
We're getting to those, so just hang on with that question. We can put that question. I also have questions on the voluntary and the elimination index. Carry on, please.
Thank you, Jefferson. Section 15I was for the arrestee index. This index was previously named the reference index, but only the name changed in the 2013 version of the bill. The arrestee index contains forensic DNA profiles taken under the power conferred by Chapter 3 of the CPA and the Firearms Control Act and the Explosive Act. It's important not to confuse the arrestee and offensive indexes. This is provided when an arrestee profile does not form part of the offensive index and thus have not yet been convicted of an offense but merely arrested as a suspect.
Arrestee index, any questions on that? Are we clear on that? Okay, let's continue, please. 15J.
Thank you, Chairperson. Section 15J provides for the offenders index. The offenders index was previously known as the convicted offenders index, so just the convicted part has been removed as it's been applied. The offenders index will contain forensic DNA profile taken under the power conferred by Section 36D of the Criminal Procedures Act, that was profile that was entered into the arrestee index, but an arrestee has subsequent to the entering of his or her profile on the arrestee index has been convicted of an offence, which can move the name from the arrestee index to the offender index. And also a profile that was taken from a person convicted of an offence either before or after the coming into operation of this Act. Members of the committee can further interrogate the relationship between the arrestee and offender index in order to ensure that the movement between the two indexes are not are done properly and not duplicated.
Questions on the on the offenders index? Can I kick off? Can you practically indicate to us how is it going to work? The reason why we're doing offenders index is one, to populate the DNA database, two, to see whether people that we are looking for on crime X is not in jail already because they've been convicted on crime Y. Practically, how is this going to work? You now get the samples from Correctional Services, starts to run a comparative search from a crime scene, and they see that person Y is in jail for a crime, another crime. How practically is this going to work now? Can somebody indicate to us how it's going to work within the criminal justice system? Do we now take that person Y in jail, get charged with a new crime, and he gets going through a new trial at the time? Can we just get a practical example of how it's going to work? Honourable Kulawanat, and then Honourable Mzolo.
Yeah, I think building onto that question, we've had the issue for a long time that the databases don't speak to each other. Correctional Services doesn't speak to SAPS, doesn't speak to Home Affairs, doesn't speak to anybody at all. So, I mean, are we looking at physically transporting? I mean, where are the links where you should be able to get those samples straight from Correctional Services feeding straight to your systems? Is that to be established, or what system are you envisaging? Because that has been a major technical disaster that we've inherited.
I just want, before you speak, members must remember there will be only one DNA database. So the samples of Correctional Services will be in such a database. There won't be a separate database. Honourable Ndlovu?
Now, build up in what you just asked, Jefferson. does that mean that for a person who is presumed to be same in the same time sin or did the same crime in Posmo and the other one is in Joburg, the other one is in Posmo will be taken sample, or are we saying that everybody who is in the correctional service will be taken? What does it mean really?
Do you want to give over to the public?
Yeah, I think as you rightly said, there's only one database. And if I can mention the example, it can happen that a person commits a rape and he's being arrested after that. Upon the crime scene, the sample was collected, which will link the person. So once it comes on the database and you make the link that this specific person, he might then already be in jail for another offense. Once that person is linked up, and of course the person will be charged, as Jefferson said, it will be a new trial. He's already convicted on one, but he will be taken to court and then the process will follow on that outstanding crime. So it might be that once a person gets in jail and we have this system of taking DNA samples of a person who has been convicted, that we might resolve crimes that has been committed some years ago. That's basically all I can add.
I will see an interesting problem.
Can I?
If what is said by correctional services, and I think that's why the Honourable Bloor was also asking this question, I will see an interesting problem if what is said by correctional services committee about collusion with wardens and people being taken out and while they are in jail committing a crime and suddenly you find the crime on the crime scene, the DNA of the person, whose
defense
will be that I've been
jailed
at that point in time. And how are we
going to
deal with that if that's
true? Perhaps I can handle this one from the technical aspect. DNA is so unique, it is not funny. It's so unique such that it may only at this stage not be so unique to identical twins. Unless that arrestee proves that it's an identical twin, there may be something else. So it also has some links from the statistical point of view. In giving a comparison results, we attach a statistical map. The question is, what are the chances that it could be another person in a population? The statistics results in our results, it turns out 1 in 1 trillion, 1 in 500 trillion, 1 in zillions. It means how much is the population of the world in relation to what the statistical outputs are. It actually places to the court a fair judgment in terms of how can it be that it could be another person outside the one who's in there. So it arrests that portion where the person said, but I was in jail at this point in time. So it the person may be able to tell us now where the identical twin in which part of the world that person is. But I just wanted to bring forth to say, how do you get to report on the results that are coming out? If comparative searches, and how do we communicate to the investigating officers? I think Jenna Patan will answer that part because it's an intelligence aspect of the database. That's what we need to say that we will generate the results when even the profiles, the computer systems are programmed such that the matching profiles will tell that this profile matches this one and this one, and it will give the case numbers to say this is a particular case in George, this one is in Freenda, this one is in Free State, and it links them all together. And having linked them all together, you'll find that it is a common person or a common perpetrator which you can then assign to a particular place where a person is supposed to be. So it means even if the case is new, if we put the case today, it loaded into the database, the person is supposed to have been convicted, but it appears that they were out for some reason, it will pick that particular case up, and then those results will be communicated to the investigating officer. I think General Pashani will talk about that process.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks to the DNA, thus we are able to secure multiple sentences for people who have committed multiple crimes. So what happens is a series of, for example, rape cases are being committed. The crime sample which comes into the lab from which we are able to determine a profile, but at a particular point you are not able to link a specific person to that. It is just a profile which is on the system. Later on, maybe when that person has committed the 10th offense, he or she is being arrested. When the sample has been taken and we do the comparison, the links are realized, that information is then communicated. There is no way that that person is able to escape for the other crimes. We actually had a very interesting one a month ago, where a lady in the Northwest complained that the detective informed her that there was no profile after she went to the district surgeon immediately for sample to come to them. We then communicated two. The one was the sample that came from her that the doctor got, and the second one was the bedding. So on the bedding, we could not find anything. So when the two reports went, the detective only used this one report to say there was no semen found. But when she complained, we went into the system, we found that there is a profile. And she had said to the detective, I was raped, for example, by a person called Sian. The detective, when they went to Sian, Sian said to them, no, it's actually not me, it's Sienki. So he referred them to someone else. They left this suspect. So what we got in the lab was the profile of that Sienki. And when we did the analysis, we could not link Sienki to this particular crime. But the fortunate thing is that he also had raped somewhere, so we were able to link him with three cases there. And in the other cases, we were able to detect that the same CN who referred them to Sienki had actually raped this particular woman. And that's how we communicate that information, and we follow it up from our side to make sure that the person is ultimately behind bars.
Thank you, sir. I want to say, Jerry, in your response, can I get this one clear? Does it mean this identical twins, the DNA is the same? Is that what you were saying? Now, my question is, what if this other twin is really a criminal and this other one is not? Which one will be arrested?
Thank you, Chef. You see, that's why we always say that DNA is not the ultimate evidence. It is not the stolen. It is not the intention of us to say.
Sorry, can I just ask that the meeting at the end of the table stop? Because I struggle to concentrate on what the answers are. And I think that the presenters themselves are struggling also to make themselves heard.
Thank you. So, Honourable Lausher was saying that in those instances, like you're saying, the other one is a criminal, perhaps the other one is not. We are the DNA evidence is not saying that it is you that has created. There are other evidence that can be collected, circumstantial evidence and so forth. The people go through court, so the justice system is very effective in actually being able to isolate those ones that are not from those that are. But also, I'm privileged to say that the first part that the committee has passed on this particular bit is the fingerprinting aspect. The fingerprints of identical twins are not the same. Yes.
Member T is ready, am I right? Honourable Mzogo?
Chairperson, maybe she is under the question, but I just... What?
Honourable Mzogo, you protected, continue, please.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much. This young man is always watching me. Chairperson, no. What I'm trying to get is that if I'm arrested, I am arrested today for the crime that I've done yesterday, and my fingerprint, everything is there. But in 2 years' time, they find that I did the same thing. But now I'm still in jail. What will happen? That's a question that I wanted to know. What will happen then?
You see, that's why we shouldn't have the meetings at the same time, because General Jacob actually did answer the question. You will get charged for the second crime as well.
No. I'm already.
You will get charged for the other crime that you've done that you have not been charged for. Even if you are in jail already, you will get charged again for another crime that you've done that they haven't picked you up on yet.
Then we are going to have a long weekend on his pillow. Thank you.
No, we're not. Members, it's 10:45, we're breaking for tea, but we'll be back at 11 o'clock, please.
That's an internal systemic problem.
Yeah, but I see, because the gaps which I was worried about freedom are still there. So you're going to still be charged by lawyers for human rights.
The question, how much do we need to deal with this principal act against regulations?
Can you please just continue before you collapse?
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Now that I know that I have my homework. I can get what you want about some of human rights.
Well, the point is, you can't have it so that it can be challenged in a
hierarchy.
I'm sure somebody, if it has a gap in relation to human rights, but where are you seeing a gap?
No, there was one, for instance, the one for groups. You run, we are a group of five, you run to us, and you join us. They are looking, then they take samples of all of us. You refuse, then the warrant is
But, that's a gang as you're about. Excuse me, you're talking about somebody who this morning, running into Parliament, and stopped, we're all stopped, the driver had to drive into me, okay, into my car. I get up, there's a little of the road, and the road's leading down the middle of the hill. And the guy is so dropped up, his legs are jumping out, his eyes are like, give me your ID. He goes, he skips up and drives around my car, after my car hits him. He does a U-turn, I said, stop your policies. Chase him, halfway back to the airport, he shoots down, turn around, 1-0-1-0-1-0-1-0, he shoots down the side lane and I'm in. So I'm the ground player. I have no doubt, he'll be a member of the gang, he's a druggie, he's a whatever. Now, if he had 300 drugs around in the car and said, oh no, well, it's okay for you, because you were driving.
Yeah, but the problem is that
the problem
is human rights. If one criminal joined us, that's why I thought that we're enjoying ourselves, and then all of us.
Somewhere in the integration must go on. That's part of the integration. Then the human rights.
You're the only.
Then you must say that you can't just stop and search. They do stop and search every day,
yes.
Every week.
And that's also human rights.
Yeah.
We must stop that also.
You know, in a country where they're given 45 meals a day, you know what? What about human rights? We've got cops who stand by and watch. We've got cops who stood by and watched them murder a man. They said, no, they don't. Did you see what the cops are doing? They stood and watched while the community beat and killed the one kid, picked up a killed the cop, smacked his head open, and killed the community decided he was a man. They were going to murder him. All those folks, they're going to make thrilling episodes.
Good, yeah.
Tweeting is a wrong thing sometimes. Perhaps I didn't misspell okay though.
That is how the UN spells it. The American spelling of everything is not always correct.
Yes.
In fact, that's why you have UK English and American English. And this is how the UN spells it. So I would presume the ethical thing to do for the journalist would be to correct that tweet that they sent out, whoever that may be. Thank you. It's not a wrong spelling. So please. I really think we've got more serious issues to consider than being making assumptions that such spells something wrong, when in fact it's not spelled wrong. Grammar teachers, yeah. Let's continue, please. 16, 15, okay?
Thank you, Captain. Honourable Member. Section 15K provides for a volunteer index. A volunteer index will contain forensic DNA profiles derived with informed consent, and this is related to section 36E and other volunteers. It will also contain, it provides that a sample of a child should be put on only with the informed consent given by the parent or the guardian of that child, and the buccal samples must be taken by authorized person in a designated area. Section 15K2 states that a volunteer must consent in writing after he or she is informed of the following: the manner in which a buccal sample will be taken, that the volunteer is under no obligation to give a sample, that sample might produce evidence which can be used in court, and that evidence derived from the sample may only be used in the detection of crime, investigations, identification of unidentified human remains, or missing persons. Now, the 2009 Amendment Bill provided that once consent is given, it cannot be withdrawn. This is no longer provided for in the 2013 version. And the committee should see clearly whether this consent can be withdrawn and whether that is the reason why it was excluded from the 2030 version.
Any questions on this section of the volunteers? Can we get clarity on that issue that the researcher has raised, whether volunteer samples can be withdrawn or not? Can we get clarity on that one? Any other questions?
I think if I understand Nicolette correctly, she's saying if the volunteer has already given consent of the sample, can it be at some point in time withdrawn? Yes, I think in her first slide, I can't remember now whether it's 360, it will be withdrawn within the period. There's a period that is mentioned there. I think it says in three months after the consent has been given, so it is correct that it will be withdrawn.
Okay. And second question from my side, can you just explain to us, what is this designated area? In a designated area.
Chair, the idea is that there must be some privacy, etc. So it must be a specific area that is designated in the police station or wherever these samples are taken. And I think it's a shame but for all people, it must be taken in with a measure of privacy.
Does that not mean that we would need to get some sort of definition for a designated area?
Does it mean secure area or designated area? Or private area?
Could be definition.
I believe it's said in the bill that it will be covered by regulations, but I'm something that we might want to consider when we start dealing with the bill, designated area, definition thereof.
Yeah.
Okay, can continue please with the elimination index.
Thank you, Jason. Section 15L of the amendment will deal with the elimination index. The elimination index will contain forensic DNA profiles from buccal samples of a police official or person, which is due to the nature of his or her duties is subject to forensic elimination. As the legal official who handles processes or examines samples, any person directly involved in the manufacturing of consumables, equipment, utensils or reagents, or the servicing or calibration of equipment,
and also for any person who enters a forensic laboratory. Section 15L2 provides for the buccal sample to be taken also in a designated area. Subsection 15L3 provides for a buccal sample to be also be retaken. And subsection 15L4 provides that the DNA profile may be used in comparative search for the purposes related to the investigation of an offence.
Questions on the elimination index on the Mokulaba that you had one previously? You want to put it here?
Absolutely. The question was about, as they did with us when we visited the laboratory, it does say that, I see it says any person who visits the laboratory. Is that in visiting any, like we went as visitors or guests to a laboratory? Does it mean the people who deliver samples from some hired company? How far is it going to go? I mean, is it basically anybody who comes in the door is going to be given a sample? I don't know. Could you just fill that in, please?
Question from my side as well. On the elimination index, specifically insofar as police officers is concerned, let's say, for instance, and we've got a practical example of it, where an investigating officer was involved in the case. The investigating officer then resigns. So according to this bill, the elimination index, that person's DNA would have been taken for elimination purposes at some point. Now the person resigns. Does it now get removed from the elimination index? Does it stay there? What happens in terms of such personnel specifically, in terms of leaving the service? But also while they're in the service, because unfortunately we also know that such officers are not always on the right side of the law. And are we not running a risk of having an officer's data on the elimination index, but then at the same time that officer being involved in the very crime that he's investigating? Please don't tell me it's not possible, because we can give you examples of stations where it happened. So, where your detectives are involved. So we just want to get clarity on that issue. I think it's not a question that's trying to be difficult, but we need to close loopholes around these issues as well.
Thank you, Chairperson. May I start with a question both by Honourable Kola on who are the people that are supposed to be providing a sample? That last paragraph 15 says any person who enters forensic laboratory. In particular, we would have been more clearer on this one to say who enters a DNA laboratory, because we have visitors who, in the school children, who always want to know what our DNA, not career-wise or awareness-wise, who would like to tour DNA facilities. We have seen with the international visits that in any of the visitors, be it students, be it whoever they may be, who want to visit the DNA laboratories, an elimination sample is taken for those persons. So we may, just when we deliberate on this, perhaps streamline it to say the DNA laboratories, which will be more focused on the forensics, on particular samples within the elimination databases. On the question that the chair raised on the police officer having resigned, I think we were also silent in this deliberation. I think it is true that it happened. It can happen. That's the reason why we actually would want to have an elimination database, to eliminate contamination purposes. It may happen that when the people are processing the samples in the lab, they would say, my profile is there because I contaminated it. I was the one working with it. Well, in fact, there were perpetrators in that sense. So it is also interesting that with our processes, you may see if the sample has behaved or the profile is as a result of a contaminant, or is the profile failing that it was, you know, a voluntary crime exercise. So in those instances where a police officer might have been on an elimination index, and it appears that in fact it can be linked to others, that's one of the intentions why we would want to have this, so that we also eliminate, you know, the kind of people who are committing crime unknowingly. You know, one of the reasons why we promote the DNA database is for those silent investigations, that no other evidence can come forth, you know, to can highlight those. So it will be important for us that those kind of individuals are identified. But on the matter of removing the police officers who had resigned from the service
or from employment, we didn't make that provision of expenses like the volunteer index. It may be that we may also include that with the elimination index, you may have to expunge within 3 months or whatever period they decide.
Yeah, I think it's something that we need to apply our mind to. You might not want to do it within 3 months, depending on the time frames of investigations, etc., etc. So, but it's something that we need to look at. If we can just note that when we start deliberating on the issue. You can continue, Nicolette.
Thank you, Jefferson. Section 15N provides for the comparative DNA search and the communication of information. The section provides that a report may be finished on the result of comparative search to a person who requires it for the performance of his or her function in terms of Section 15N, which deals with foreign law enforcement agencies. It may also be furnished to a person who of necessity supplies it in the performance of his or her function. Also in respect of information required in terms of any law, evidence in any court of law, a competent authority requiring it for their institution or an investigation which will include a preliminary investigation or inquiry. It can also be furnished for criminal defense purposes to an accused person, or whether it is the child, he is a parent, legal guardian, or legal representative.
Questions, clarity, or we be on this? Seems so. Can we continue, please?
Thank you, Jefferson. Section 15N of the amendment bill provides for a forensic DNA profile received from a foreign state or recognized international organization, tribunal or entities to be compared with those on the South African DNA database. These can be done for the detection of crime, the investigation of an offense, conducting of a prosecution, identification of a missing person, or identification of unidentified human remains. These results may be communicated directly to the requester. Provision is made for DNA profiles limited to those contained in crime scene index to be communicated to a foreign state or an international organization. International law enforcement agencies was previously excluded in the 2009 version, which only made provision for foreign law enforcement agencies.
Any questions here? Are we clear? Continue, please.
Thank you, Jefferson. Section 15O deals with the compliance with quality management system. It was for the authorized officer and no longer the national commissioner to develop and recommend standards for quality management, including standards for testing the proficiency of forensic science laboratories and analysts conducting forensic DNA analysis. The section also removed all reference to privately operated forensic science laboratories made in the 2009 version. The use of privately operated forensic science laboratories was identified as a concern during the 2009 public hearings, as it was argued that the removal of such a core business of SAPS should not be outsourced. Also, one of the main concerns that were raised was the quality assurance of these private laboratories, which will be challenging.
Any questions around this? I think also since 2009, the capacity of SAPS have increased dramatically in dealing with this issue as well. Continue, please.
Yeah, I'm a bit concerned with the complete removal of any reference to private laboratories. In our oversight trip, there was reference in both countries to the need, because of capacity, to utilize the services of private security laboratories. And obviously they were given very high clearance and had their very type security checks, but to remove it entirely means that if SAPS has the need to utilize private laboratories at any stage in the next umpteen years, who knows when this will ever be looked at again, it is expressly forbidding them from ever utilizing the services of a private laboratory. So I just think that it would be an area where it should possibly be left in as a reference, as a possibility for future use, because to just blank it out now just seems to be closing a door that may need to be opened, and we're going to especially forbid it in this legislation.
Honourable George.
Madam Chair, I would advise that we leave that for our debate, because I might have a different view. I don't think this is the appropriate time to engage in discussions.
Can I just get an indication? Is there somebody from the department who would like to react on this one? Not necessary. Okay. Let's continue, please. Section 15B.
Thank you, Chairperson. Section 15B provides for the retention, storage, destruction, and disposal of plantain and buckle samples. And members should know that there is a difference between a sample and the actual profile. The sample is the swab or that's taken from a currency, and the profile will be then derived from the sample, and the storage of the two is quite different. Section 15B provides the sample must be destroyed within 3 months after a profile is loaded onto the DNA database. However, the section is a bit confusing, as it starts off by providing the sample not used to populate the DNA database will be destroyed within 3 months, and then states that this must be done only after a DNA profile was created and stored on the DNA database. The committee could just seek some clarity on this.
Over to the department for clarity, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not certain what is not clear in this particular matter. I'm just trying to figure out what isn't clear. In terms of
on the one hand, it says that it be destroyed. In 3 months, it's not going to be used to populate. But then at the next point, it says it can't be destroyed before it populates the DNA database. So on the one hand, it says it's destroyed because it's not going to be used. And on the other hand, it says it can't be destroyed before it's populated the DNA database.
Thanks, Chair. I think this point is very important. I think it ties up to the question that the Honourable Gordon asked previously on the familiar searches, which point is raising some two issues that I think the committee may want to deliberate on when the debate process comes in. The use of the DNA profiles in terms of identification of missing persons or unidentified bodies. Because that provision of this particular reference in the first discussions were referring to those instances where a sample is not going to be used to be loaded on the DNA database for those types of searches. So it is in this case that in the line of thought of those types of samples, we may have to fine-tune those areas to see which particular samples are they referred to now. When the familial search were removed, where the elements that were not completely removed from the particular base. So at the point of discussion, we may have to really look into the use of the profile in those instances of identifying these persons and identifying bodies in line with what this thing said. However, with the rest of what Nicolette was saying in terms of storage of the samples, we after the sample is loaded or the profile is loaded on the database, only then can the samples be destroyed, and according to the capacities and how we foresee the processes going forward, within that period, within 3 months, the original sample, the genetic material must be destroyed.
So we hear that we need some fine-tuning in terms of this section. So if we can ask the drafters, I see the state law advisors are not here today. Obelwa, I'm going to ask that you make sure that they attend the next meetings, because they need to start taking note of the issues that we've got concerns about. Can we continue then?
Thank you, Chairperson. If we move on to section 15Q, it provides for the retention of forensic DNA profiles. The arrestee index should be expunged within 3 years after the authorized officer has been informed that a decision was taken not to prosecute the individual, that the person was acquitted at trial,
that the conviction was satisfied in appeal or review, that a person is discharged at the preparatory examination, that if no criminal proceedings with regard to such a DNA profile was instituted, and the prosecution had declined to prosecute. DNA profiles on the volunteer index will be expunged within 3 months after the officer is informed that a case is finalized. Also, if a volunteer gives consent that a profile may be retained for a longer period, then he or she may request that the profile be expunged, and this must be done within 3 months of receiving the request. Profiles on the crime scene index is kept indefinitely. Profiles on the elimination index is also kept indefinitely. Profiles on the offenders index is also kept indefinitely, although it's not stated as such in the amendment bill. And also, upon the conviction of a child, the DNA profile will be expunged in terms of Section 87 of the Child Justice Act of 2008. Questions for clarity, members? Honourable George?
Madam Chair, the arrestee index.
Huh?
To be informed why?
Within 3 years. That's a long period.
3 years after the authority. I mean, let's take somebody, the
person that was acquitted. Why do you keep for such a long time
after the person is not there?
Or work one that is, the prosecution said no prosecution, it means there's no evidence against this person.
Honourable Steven, Honourable McLaughlin.
Chair, also on the arrestee index, why only 3 years? Why not keep it for longer? Because I presume that's for future crime that might happen. Why only for 3 years and not 5 or 10 years? Thank you.
I just want to clarify on offenders index, Chairperson. What is the position?
Yeah, just a comment from my side as well. I think you need to explain to us the 3 year logic around that. But the other one is that I think we've already made the point around the elimination index. Where are we going in terms of that? I can now join SAPS, get my DNA on the elimination index, then leave SAPS and stop committing crimes in my private capacity, or resign and my DNA is on the elimination index all the time. So can we I'm just not saying that you need to respond to it. I'm just highlighting that this is obviously an issue that we need to look at and consider carefully, or maybe understand better. And then Honourable Lobo had asked the question of the offenders index. Is the intention to keep it indefinitely? If so, why are we not stating it outright?
I'm just checking on my colleague, because he wants to respond. Senator Jacobs, do you want to respond? And the 3 years.
Chair, we followed actually the wording here of in the fingerprints legislation, except that I think in the case of fingerprints, they must be destroyed within 3 months. I think this related to also to capacity issues, etc., within the laboratory. And I think that was the only reason why it was made longer than with the fingerprints.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to add on what Senator Jacobs is saying, just on the practical aspects. Because the lab will be receiving thousands of samples. I don't want to say millions, I might just be prophesying millions. Maybe I must just say thousands and keep that number. So as the samples are coming in, you still want to destroy the samples. You distract that process. That's the one part. Now this is the sample part. It's capacity, because it's quality systems, you must always prove that, keep a paper trail, have the systems. Now you've got to also do it on the profiles, on the database. This is a separate issue. Now we've got to deal with those ones. So capacity-wise, we'll be more involved distracting and expunging more than processing and doing comparative searches. So allow time, such that there is enough time so that you are able to balance the two categories. Because really, you don't want to overcapacitate the environment as well in terms of people, but then it will go until a specific number where we are able to manage those resources more efficiently. So yes, the 3 years is quite reasonable. We in fact had suggested that 10 years, and then they thought, what, 10 years, you know, capacity-wise, so that really it's finalized. It's not going to be reused because there are ethical concerns. There are provisions in the same legislation if it is used, what are the penalties. So there will be written quality assurance issues, ethical issues, oversight will be there to monitor the process. So we thought it is quite reasonable to keep it at a point given the work that needs to be performed, as well as the expungements and distractions as well in the particular process. So that's why they are kept for so long.
Let us just complete an answer, then I will come back to members.
The other question was on the clarity of the offender index. Is there an intention to keep the samples indefinitely? The intention is no. I think Nicolette is correct to say it is not clearly defined to say it is low, but given its silentness, it's presumed that it is indefinite. Because once a person is still a suspect, you're not convicted yet. The intention through the study is that the portfolio is completed and the report, amongst other recommendations in there, the indefinite samples were crime scene samples, as well as the convicted offender index samples, which were indefinite. The offender index is never intended to be indefinite because there is an issue of guilt and not guilt and rights and so forth. So when the debates come forth, we may have to time that process.
It's just confusing the issues now. The offender index is
convicted offender.
Convicted offender.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
I do think we need to look at the RETI index and the time frames, because I do think there is a difference in terms of acquittal in a court of law. And while a case is running, you can still argue that it should be there. And we also know that cases can take 5-6 years to be finalized, so that we need to take in consideration as well. And then in terms of the offenders index, I think another thing that we will have to keep in mind is once a person has applied for expulsion of the criminal record, that obviously will have to play a role as well, because there's clear laws around that. Even if a person was convicted and they at some point asked for expulsion of that record, it obviously needs to be reflected. So if we could just make notes of those as well. Honourable George, you wanted to add something?
In fact, I was on the same issue now that you say we'll have to talk about it. But the reason given by General is it's not really convincing, but we'll debate it at the right time. Because if it's only the question of capacity, will you ask a question about volunteer index? It's true, those differences. And all that besides, if what I'm saying is about thousands, surely you would put a unit to deal with that. That's what I'm saying, it's only the question of capacity, no principle. But to deal with it, Madam Chair, because you've already ruled that we'll have to come back with it.
Let's continue, please.
Thank you, Joseph. Section 15F allows for offences and penalties in terms of their database. The section is aligned with those implemented in the 2010 bill that amended the fingerprint component. Both provided for contraventions which are liable to conviction for a period not exceeding 6 years in imprisonment. The section provides for the following offences. When if a person uses or allows the use of harmful and forensic DNA profiles for any purpose not related to the uses stipulated in the Act. If a person tampers with or manipulates the process of samples, or if a person falsely claims that a sample or forensic DNA profile is derived or taken from a specific person while knowing them to have been taken from another person.
That's in line with the fingerprint part of the bill as well. I don't think there can be any confidence around that. Let's continue, please.
Thank you, Jefferson. Section 15T of the Amendment Bill deals with the national instruction.
The 2009 Amendment Bill provided that National Commissioner must issue their national instructions in consultation with the Minister of Police. This is no longer required through the 2013 version, and the national instruction is now issued by the National Commissioner alone. The national instruction should include the following. Firstly, the manner in which to procure crime scenes for the purposes of collecting crime scene samples. Secondly, the manner in which to safely preserve and ensure timely transfer of collected samples to the forensic science laboratories. Thirdly, the manner in which to request access to information stored on the DNA database. And lastly, the manner in which DNA samples shall be destroyed. The section through sections 2 and 3 also determines that the national instruction issued by the National Commissioner must be tabled in Parliament within 6 months after the commencement of the section, and that the National Commissioner or his or her delegate must develop a awareness program in respect of the national instructions referred to above.
Questions, members? My immediate question is around the awareness programs and why not training. Why are we saying awareness programs and not training? Because, quite frankly, our biggest issue with the fingerprint legislation is that at station level, your detectors still don't know about the fingerprint legislation. And are not utilizing it properly. They're not asking for comparative searches being done with Home Affairs, e-natives, etc.
I read this, the first paragraph correctly, if I say Chairperson, National Commissioner, now won't contact the Minister at all. Does it say that?
Maybe that's not necessarily a problem, because regulations is sub-legislation. National instructions is not. It's operational issues. So what we need to do and what we need to apply our mind around is whether we want to see regulations, whether the committee wants to have insight into the regulations, if not the whole bill, or sections of the bill at least. And I think, for instance, the issues about the national instructions should include the following also means that the committee should have insight into the regulations on those same issues at least, at the very least. Because the regulation will direct the, if I'm correct, the instruction. So it's not necessarily a problem. What is important is that the commissioner cannot develop the regulations. The regulations are sub-legislation, and therefore the minister needs to develop those. Mr. Jacobs, Commissioner
Cesi. Chair, just to say as well that the difference between this and the fingerprint legislation is that there's a very strict oversight in terms of that committee. And whatever the National Commissioner will do in terms of national instructions, of course, will also be subject to the oversight of that committee. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I wanted to respond on why awareness and not training. The following clause provides training, 15 new. But in this particular one is the national instructor to talk to awareness of all staff members, which is not necessarily the focus of the training. The training that will be given to people will be directly impacted will surely differ from those initially want to promote the awareness. So in particular instance, it was talking to the awareness to all, but training is referred to in the next. Yes.
Can you please, on the training part?
Thank you, Chair Clifford. The training is provided for in Section 15U of the Amendment Bill. Just to tie into with Chair Clifford's question around training, in the 2009 Amendment Bill, training was included in the section dealing with the national instruction, but it had been put out and elevated to be in a specific separate section which gives it greater importance. The section is thus newly inserted, and it provides that the National Commissioner must ensure that adequate training programs are developed in order to support the implementation and the administration of the national DNA database. Section 15V provides for the regulation to the Amendment Bill. It provides that the Minister must make regulations regarding any matter which is required or permitted by Chapter 5B, to be prescribed and also the administrative or procedural methods necessary or expedient to give effect to the provisions of this chapter. Section Subsection 2 provides that the regulation made under subsection may prescribe a fine or a period of imprisonment for any contravention thereof or failure to comply therewith. And it is not clear whether section refers to the possibility of a fine, while section 50F expressly removes the option of a fine in any contravention of the requirements set out in Chapter 5B. The regulations normally must be tabled before Parliament, but the amendment bill does not say this expressly, and the committee could consider whether the regulations must be tabled for approval or merely notification.
It is clearly something that we will debate when we get to it. It can be very tedious for committee to deal with regulations in its totality, but there might be certain sections of it that we feel we want to not only note but agree to. Can we get clarity on the fine issue in here? Because for me that's a big concern. You know, that we can have in regulation, with sub-legislation, something less than what is in the legislation. So can we get clarity on that issue, please?
Chair, I think when it comes to regulations, of course, the you will see that also the period of imprisonment is limited in terms of the, or more limited as respect of the Act. But I think it should provide for a fine as well, because there might be less serious offences when a fine is warranted instead of imprisonment.
Maybe it's just a question that our patients with substance are running very, very thin at this stage, that we do not see the necessity for fines at this stage. But let's get to that point when we get to it, because it's unfortunately that same thing that results in us having people with criminal records still in subs. And that's unfortunately the truth. So I think it's something that we will have to apply our minds to members whether we agree with this or not. And I think, Commissioner Jacobs, if you want to convince us about this, you've got to come with practical examples of where you think a fine would be more suitable than a conviction, a jail sentence, especially in light of the fact that we are already suggesting that we put in the time frames in the Act and not in regulations. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. Section 15W deals with parliamentary oversight. Subsection 1 determines that the National Commissioner should prepare a report for the Minister of Police on an annual basis to report to the performance of the DNA database and the use of forensic DNA evidence in the investigation of crime. It further determines that the report must be tabled to Parliament by the Minister. The 2009 Amendment Bill set definite time frames associated with this report. These time frames have now been omitted or removed from the 2013 version. Subsection 2 determines that the Minister must submit a report to Parliament specifically on whether any legislative amendments are required to improve the functioning of the database and the use of forensic DNA evidence in the combating of crime within 5 years after the commencement of the session. The 2009 Amendment Bill strictly made provision that the Minister of Parliament or an authorised committee of Parliament may request a report on the operation of the database from the National Commissioner at any point in time. This is not included in the 2013 version of the bill.
Members, questions? I clearly have. I time frames, I do think we will have to apply minds to time frames. Can't be an open-ended thing. Normally it's within 30 days after the end of the financial year or at the annual report phase, but we need to have time frames in this. And I do think this committee or any other committee of Parliament should be able, like it is in any case, but if, I don't think there's harm in putting in there explicitly that this committee have the right, that Parliament have the right to call for reports at any other point in time. What happens, for instance, if we again get a report like we got earlier this year about the rape kits? Then surely we must have the ability to to call the National Commissioner and say, please come and report to us on what is the situation. So I think these two issues we must just mark for further deliberation when we get it. Anything else, members? Honourable George?
Madam Chairman, they were there in the previous. Did I thought the learned friends would be able to explain why they were removed, even if we're going to discuss it.
Can we get an explanation, please?
Chair, I think when we come to the next session, session on the establishment and composition of the forensic oversight board, I think you will find that there is a very strict oversight, and I think that was the reason why that has not been repeated yet. And as the chairperson said, the committee does have the ability to instruct the department to give reports on it. But you will also see that in the oversight board, there's a very strict oversight on all activities surrounding to the implementation as well as the application of the Act. And I think that is the reason why it is not reflected exactly as in the bill, because the oversight committee is something that has been added to the bill.
I don't think members are convinced by it, because no. The oversight committee can never take the role of parliament. So, but we'll discuss it when we get to the deliberations of the bill. While we welcome the oversight board and we think it's very necessary, it can never take the place of parliament. Let's continue, please.
Thank you, Josephine. Section 15X. It deals with the aspect and security of the database. There's inserts a new section in W5B and referring to access to the national DNA database and the security of the database. The section determines that the National Commissioner must secure the integrity of information on the database by taking appropriate, reasonable, technical and organizational measures to prevent the loss of damage to or unauthorized destruction of information on a database and also the unlawful access to or processing of information on the database. The section through subsection 2 further determines four measures that must be taken by the National Commissioner to ensure the above. The National Commissioner must identify all reasonable, foreseeable internal and external risks to information on the database under his or her control, establish and maintain appropriate safeguards against the risk identified, regularly verify that the safeguards are effectively implemented and ensure that the safeguards are continually updated in response to new risks or deficiencies in previously implemented safeguards.
Any questions, members? Something that I think we might want to consider at this point as well, just mentioning it, is whether we would like this to form part of the annual report on the DNA database. I think it would make sense in that way one would be able to keep track that there is actually a review of security of the database. So that what I'm suggesting is that we as a committee might want to consider to make this part of the report that must come to a minister and to parliament after the minister has received it. Continue, please.
Thank you, Jefferson. Section 15Y is the last section of the Clause 6, and it provides for the establishment of an oversight board, which will be known as the National Forensic Oversight Board. The National Forensic Oversight Board is solely appointed by the Minister of Police, who also appoints the chairperson of the board. The National Forensic Oversight Board is to consist of the following representatives. A representative from the Department of Health, the Department of Home Affairs, the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, and the Department of Correctional Services. Also, there's a Civilian Secretariat for Police and the Secretary of Police, or he or a representative. Also, two representatives appointed by relevant non-governmental organizations to collectively represent them where, in the opinion of the chairperson, they can substantially contribute to the proceedings of the board. The section further determines that the National Forensic Oversight Board can formally invite the South African Human Rights Commission to be part of the board or to participate in the proceedings of the board, subject to the willingness
and approval of the South African Human Rights Commission. The purpose of the National Forensic Oversight Board is to monitor the implementation of legislation relating to sample collection, forensic DNA analysis, and the National Forensic DNA Database. It's also to make proposals on the governance and integrity of the DNA database, to monitor and make proposals on the conducting and performance of the forensic DNA analysis and the DNA database, to monitor compliance with ethical and privacy issues, to propose minimum quality standards to be implemented and maintained in performing forensic DNA analysis and the operation of the DNA database, to promote public accountability and transparency with respect to performing forensic DNA analysis and the operation of the DNA database, and lastly, to advise the Minister on reviewing legislation, regulations, policy, and protocols concerning matters under this chapter and Chapter 3 of the Criminal Procedure Act. The Forensic Oversight Board does have some financial implications. It is said in the bill that the proceedings of the National Forensic DNA Oversight Board will be funded from the budget of the Minister, and that the Minister may, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, determine the remuneration or payment of expenses of members of the Forensic Oversight Board who are not appointed in terms of the FAP Act, the Public Service Act, and Correctional Services Act.
Members, questions, comments, clarity? Honourable Toon.
Thanks, Chairperson. On the composition of the National Forensic Oversight Board, just clarity. Wouldn't it be proper that maybe the composition there? The Department of International Relations and Cooperation is also forms part of that board, oversight board.
Honourable Member, can you motivate why you say that?
Chairperson, if I remember properly, on the preceding slide, there was a mention of outside or perpetrators or victims from other countries. So I would think that it would be imperative that maybe the Department of International Relations and Cooperation also forms part of it.
Okay, I also have two questions. One is more comment. I think one committee members, we need to look at the name of this board. Ethics was part of it, and I think the name ethics should reflect in the name of the board as well. It's not only about oversight, it's about ethics as well, National Oversight and Ethics Board, something like that. Second question is ethics. If ethics forms part of this board, then this board has also been able to receive complaints by people who feel that their rights have been infringed upon. And I don't think this board is currently making provision for that. So we might want to look at that as well. Members will remember specifically in the UK when we spoke to the ethics board that it is an issue. And that's in a country without a Bill of Rights. So in our country, I do think we need to make provision for that. I'm not foreseeing that there will be lots of it, but let's rather make provision than not. So can I put that on the table for us to debate when we get to that point, so that both two proposals. If the department can just respond to the question of the international relations, it might also be that you want to deal with it like you do with the Human Rights Commission as and when needed. I've been thinking about aircraft disasters or something like that, you might have a role then, but I think where it's criminal, it will be more through Interpol than it would be through international relations. If you could just respond to that as well, please.
Chair, when it comes to purely investigative issues, the exchange of this type of information is normally through Interpol. But when it comes to mutual legal assistance, where things are required as evidence, and you need to follow certain legal procedures in order to obtain certain information, then mutual legal assistance might be applicable. In that case, the Department of International Relations and Cooperation sort of act as a conduit for such applications to the South African government. And those applications are then sent to the Department of Justice and then again to Interpol. So I don't think there's a, except for that sort of post office sanction that the department fulfills, there is that much need. But I would agree with the chairperson that if we put it in maybe on a needs basis, and maybe not as part of the general operation of the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Can we ask the department to apply your mind in this regard? There might be other departments that you also from time to time on a needs basis want to involve. Maybe with just a general provision for something like that that we can look at in future. Okay, let's continue, please.
Thanks, Josephine and Honourable Members. We now move on to the amendments made to the Firearms Control Act of 2000. These were Clause 7 and 8. Clause 7 provides only for the alignment of definitions, and these are similar to those in Clause 1 and will not be repeated. Clause 8 amends Section 113 of the Firearms Control Act to provide for the taking of buccal samples by an authorized person and the taking of bodily samples by a registered medical practitioner or a registered nurse. Clause 8 also provides or amends Section 1131 of the Firearms Control Act, which only provides for fingerprints or body prints to be taken without a warrant by a police official when there are reasonable grounds to suspect that a person or group of persons have committed an offence, punishable by a period of 5 years imprisonment or longer, and to include or exclude these persons as suspects in an investigation. The subsection 3A is inserted to ensure that buccal samples are taken in terms of the relevant sections of the Criminal Procedure Act, which are sections 36A2 regarding children, also section 3 with concern to warrant, or section 36D in the designated area. I mean, it's important to read these two together. Because if you only read the amendments to section 1131, it might seem that samples cannot be taken without a warrant. But if you read it in conjunction with subsection CA, it becomes then clear that it is still under the provisions made by the rest of the amendments also. If we go on immediately to the Explosive Act, which are amended by Clause 9 and 10. Clause 9 again amends Section 1 of the Explosive Act, which provides for the alignment of definitions, which are the same as in Clause 1. Clause 10 amends Section 9 of the Explosive Act pertaining to prints and samples for investigative purposes. Section 9 reads similar to the same as Section 113 of the Firearms Control Act. However, the amendments are not completely the same, and the committee can just during their deliberations consider these amendments. Section 5A3 is meant to include reference to the destruction of bodily samples as well as fingerprints and body samples already contained in the Act. And the subsection is amended to provide for the so-called derived in samples, unspent crimes in samples, to be destroyed within 6 months after the authorized officer has been notified. An amendment is also made here to reference to Chapter 5B of the SAP Act. Subsection 5E is inserted to make reference to the keeping of profiles from the samples in the National Forensic DNA Database.
Anything here, members, on the Firearms Control Act and the Explosives Act? Nothing?
Yeah.
Let's continue, please.
Thank you, Jefferson. Looking at the object of the amendment bill, the memorandum of the bill said that all relevant departments were consulted during the process of drafting the bill.
that there is no implications for provinces, and that the implementation of the legislation will be accompanied by a communication strategy and training for all role players to create awareness on the importance of DNA evidence and the preservation of the crime scene. The amendment bill will be dealt with an ordinary bill not affecting provinces as determined in section 35 of the Constitution, and the amendment bill will not be referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders. If we look at financial implications, the memorandum states that the provisioning of DNA reference bond vaults, collection kits, the analysis thereof, destruction of the bond vaults and infrastructure will cost apparently approximately 150 million rand annually. The cost of training for the lead officials to take DNA reference bond vaults and the conducting of forensic awareness programs in support of the implementation will cost approximately 22 million rand. It also stated that these costs are covered in terms of the CJS budget allocation. However, it is also stated whether this is also on a yearly basis or that will be done just as once off. The financial implications of the state was one of the key considerations of the Portfolio Committee of the Spring Tour in 2011 to Canada and the United Kingdom, because the information technology cost implications could be excessively expensive, and also the IT solutions associated with a national DNA database. The committee should engage the department further on cost implementations during the presentation and hereafter on the implementation plan of the proposed legislation.
Continue. We're going to deal with the implementation plan now after this, so let's continue with the rest, and then we can take our questions when we deal with the implementation plan.
Thank you, Chipson. As members know, there's also a policy document on the DNA database developed by the Civilian Secretariat for Police. The committee received a presentation on this in June last year. And it's important for members to note that as it is a policy document, it is understandable that there are some differences between the policy document and the proposed legislation. I would just like to highlight some of them. The policy document does not mention the inclusion of IFAD officers as authorized officials. The policy document states that authorized police officials will be allocated special rooms at courts and at specific police stations that are created. The policy makes provisions for the expungement of the profile of an offender after a period of 6 to 16 years if there is no further hit on that person. The bill makes no mention of the extension of these profiles. But as General Shady explained, that this will be further interrogated. The Secretary stated in 2012 that CODA should be utilized as the database software. However, the latest version of the policy document says that the additional software solution will need to be developed in South Africa to support the forensic DNA database to provide an effective system solution for the database and to legislative process. So members can maybe just engage the Secretary and the Department further on this. The policy document also addressed several human rights concerns. And regarding the oversight board, the policy proposed by the amendment bill, the current amendment bill, does not include the South African Human Rights Commission, staff or a member of the South African Society for Human Genetics as referred by the policy document. Chairperson, honourable members, in conclusion, the 2013 version showed a great improvement towards compared to the previous version that was tabled in 2009. It's important to understand that DNA evidence not automatically links to crime.
is just another tool to support in the investigations and must be supported by sound investigative technique. Some concerns that remain is the capacity in terms of personnel and laboratories to effectively analyze samples to derive profiles, the training in terms of us and IPAT members to take bulk of samples, as well as awareness on the preservation of the integrity of crime scene, especially to first respondents, the effectiveness of the oversight board, and the reach of the board to take samples from all arrested persons. And I remember the presentation has not highlighted all concerns in the amendment bill, and the full analysis document from the research unit has a lot more concerns around the world. Thank you.
Nicolette, thank you very, very much. Can I say from the side of the committee members, thank you very much. I think it's very important that we start off the process with a clear understanding what is in the bill, and I think this actually provides us with that. So thank you for the work that you've done. Can I also urge members to read, it's just a document following this presentation, to read the full analysis from the researchers on the bill itself. Is there any last questions that we want to put to the researchers before we go into the implementation plan? Nothing. Can we then go to the implementation plan? Who's going to present that for us?
Thanks, Chair. Jalal Chesi will do the presentation on the implementation plan.
Members, it's also in your file. It's just after the researchers' document. Just while they're still preparing this, I for one personally welcome the fact that SAPS is not part of the board. I think you can't be part of your own oversight body, so it makes absolute sense not to have them as part of it. We can continue, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. The implementation plan will focus specifically on the three concerns that were raised in the previous presentation. It is just when we worked out the implementation plan with different departments, the concerns were actually noted, which are concerns that are raised by the researchers themselves. One concern of which is the capacity as well as the training, they are coming out very, very clearly on the bill. This presentation will therefore cover most of those in terms of that. The concerns that I highlighted. You may see here in the continuing document that not all costs are provided. I'll give the reason for not even costs in some of these areas, given the challenges currently, but in no time we'll be able to finalize the process. But the first key to look into is the policy framework, which we've spoken about. I'm going to be talking to perhaps the first two columns and maybe the indicator. And in where it is appropriate, I will indicate the cost estimates as well so that it at least saves some time. Where there are other departments that are highlighted, also I'll just quickly refer that so that it doesn't take too much of your time. The policy framework was dealt with, and Nicolette has already elaborated on that. With responsibility of the Secretariat, as we presented, we did not estimate any cost in there. We had worked in consultation with the Secretariat. That document has been presented to date. Number two, it talks to the drafting of the national instructions. I think the committee members are taking note that for the bill, we have to compile the national instructions. This is an ongoing process which should be, the provision is made that once the bill is passed, within 6 months, the national instructions should be implemented. We have, however, begun the process of compiling the national instructions. It says that what is our current status, compiling the draft national instruction as well as the SOP. The SOP will then be the operational documents that will be based on what is the intention of the national instruction. These documents will be adapted and refined depending on what the final outcome of the debate has in terms of this particular bill. And the process is done internally, part of the salaries in there, so that part is also not costed. We've been doing this with our legal services, even our legal office, as well as the members from the Department of Correctional Services who have been part of the deliberations from the beginning. The next point talks to providing the awareness or training to focus groups. This is a point that I really just want to a little bit in detail on, because it's mainly the particular focus of the spell. It can only realize once all the people are trained on it. It may be a challenge to train everybody as a first timer, but it is critical that everybody gets to be trained at some point in time. However, we have to prioritize our training. Are we going to be rolling that out? What is our current status in terms of this training, or what is the requirement really, the implicated driver? Provide forensic awareness or the training to focus groups. We have four different focus groups in terms of the training that must be given. If you look at current status, you can talk to the training, the third line in there. I don't now have a little bit of a pointer so that I can just talk to the different groups before I talk to what is our limitations there. It has the forensic awareness people that will provide specialized courses to crime scene people, to the detectives, to the basic learning course for the police, to medical practitioners. The list goes on terms of the different groups that need to be trained. But if I read through the presentation that is done, we currently have a little bit of a limited forensic awareness initiative groups, just because of the internal training that we provide in-house on our newly recruited people that will do the training of DNA for people that are working on the laboratories. But we have identified this as a gap. Among others, we are working also during our recruitment strategies to get people to be appointed in those positions where they will be able to provide the necessary training to whoever is coming on board. So the first part there talks to the limited forensic awareness initiatives group, the focus group. What is the action plan that we've taken now, identify specific areas in which forensic awareness and training is needed to ensure successful implementation of the bill. We have done that already. We have determined from the detectives, for example, which clusters will go first, which commanders will go first on the visitor side, which will go first in the question side, who will be identified first. That has been done, and that was not costly because it's part of the people that are working on this project are employed for such that are providing that. That is also available in Jefferson for distribution to members. Limited dedicated personnel available to provide forensic awareness initiatives. The action step is infrastructure established with dedicated personnel appointed to develop adequate forensic awareness strategy and initiatives. We've costed this to be 2 million rand. When we're getting ready to get the people or the police officials trained on collecting the samples, we had gone through a process of a bid. We had wanted to go through a bid process, but with the engagement with the Department of Health, we realized that through them, we can provide the National Health Services to assist us with the training initiative. Although the training will be provided by the Department of Health, funding will be coming from the police side. We have estimated the cost for that. We are just awaiting the finalization of that process to say when do we kickstart the training, because it is a provision in the National Health Act that this training can only be conducted by the medical practitioners. Number three talks to the current training. Current training provides include specialized courses, advanced crime scene courses, DNA recovery courses, courses for crime scene examiners. These are courses now focused on the people that are internal to the environment. You will realize that the crime scene management capacity resides within Division Forensic Services. It is still the responsibility of the database of the DNA personnel to provide training to the crime scene members how to collect samples, how to package the samples, how to transport the samples, and from all those parties are now particularly referring to crime scene samples. Remember in the bill we said that the crime scene people cannot collect the backup sample or the reference samples. They will be collected by the detectives or other medical practitioners. We have fostered this particular one to be saying it's about 20 million per annum. Now given the different materials, the refreshers, the packaging, and so forth, we've got to do a practical training. We have realized with our history that the knowledge-based training that we've been providing is not so much effective. So the practical aspects of it are forming more of a context after we have deliberated with National Health on the scope of the training that must go into the bill. So if you go really from the taking of the sample, what is the DNA sample, how do you go about doing it, how do you actually engage and perform the collection, so it's quite an elaborate training. Estimated to now continue 20 million per annum for the different focus groups. The detective courses include modules on forensics, basic police learning, contains very limited material on forensics. It has come up numerous times from the committee to say at which point is the forensic course going to be given at entry level in the police or at basic detective in the police. We have consulted with Division HRD. We are working on revising the training modules to incorporate the training on DNA. So it means even the kits that are used to utilize, they will also be forming part of the training official training program in the division there. So this process is also ongoing just to get ready for implementation of the bill. That's the focus was now for internally for the police. The 4.1 relates to mandatory collection of DNA reference samples by medical professionals. The training that must go in through there and who must go in there. This one is also costed at about 6 million rand. Training to police officials according to the requirements of the National Health Act and the regulations to collect particularly the barcode samples. Now this training, unlike the different one, the previous one was talking to crime scene samples, this one is talking to particular barcode samples. Now this one is referred now also to the detectives. They are the first prioritized groups, the disease are the prioritized groups, the medical staff are prioritized groups. Like I said earlier to the chairperson, how we are going to be rolling it out is contained in the operations. This is just in my high level to show what are the categories of training or which focus groups will be targeting as of implementation. The estimated cost for this one is about 6 million for the various groups or various target groups. The next one talks to the number of samples. What are the numbers that you anticipate to collect? One of the questions that we ask, given this bill, if you pass it, what is your estimated number of samples that you will collect per annum? Now, it is not referring to crime scene samples, it's referring to barcode samples, or those ones who have been convicted offenders, or the arrestees. How many of such do you anticipate? This number is based on history and a little bit of estimation going forward. But currently, we process about 80,000 samples per annum for the people. In the estimated one, it will be about 250,000, which we anticipate it will be more than four times what we are currently getting, was just about that part. We are anticipating to be processing this number of samples, the collection kits, the transportation thereof, the packaging, the storage. This is estimated at about 125 million per annum. Aligning the DNA policy with the bill with regard to the destruction of the DNA samples. The question was also posed today, how are we going to go about destroying the DNA samples? I think neglect it well to present the different types of the samples as well as from the profiles. This particular one refers to the samples. How much do you anticipate spending on the destructions? Because now it comes with the provisions of the Occupational Health and Safety Act, also the provisions of the National Environmental Management Act in terms of managing hazardous waste and so forth. So this one is also estimated it should have read 10 million there. I think it's really 1 million per annum.
It's 10 million?
Yes. The DNA database aligns to the bill. The current PSWAC system is used to perform comparative searches. The configuration is not currently alive, very intensive process. I think earlier on, what the general was asking, and previously the members of the House asked, how are you currently utilizing the DNA database? Have you gone beyond the law, or what is the current practice? And we actually made the provisions in terms of Section 225 and how we do the current processing. But it is the intention to get a system solution. I think one of the issues that can collect raised was to implement the system solution to manage the database. Will it be CODIS? Will it be a different system? Will it be any other system that you are going to be utilizing for the DNA comparative searches? The estimated cost for that per annum is 3 million. As it is contained in them. With that, we expect to be having the system that is reputable internationally with the law enforcement agencies, so that we may not have a different language or corresponding languages when we've got to communicate profiles with different law enforcement. Somebody may ask, why did you not legislate CODIS? If CODIS does not exist tomorrow, must we change the legislation for CODIS? It's almost out of step that has been the discussions of the past, but what is the system that is going to be utilized in-house, it will then go on depending on what is the outcome of the formal bid processes in that regard. And the whole paragraph on this particular one really talks to comparative searches or the types of profiles that are contained within the DNA database, for how many profiles are being searched, for how many has been, what is the current status with regard to the comparative searches in the lab, and what is an estimated capacity needed in terms of processing this. In 5.1.2, it says appoint and train additional members, appointed and trained by March 2015. Yeah, in June we've already appointed 5 members already. In this financial year, as part of the capacitation of the forensics, we'll be getting 710 new recruits, which will be distributed in accordance with where the needs are. Having scoped all the processes, we will know in the forensic DNA database capacity how many of the analysts are needed, in the training capacity how many are needed, just in the DNA process itself how many people are needed. We already have 710 of such posts. I think the compensation money is about 400 million for that, which money has not been reflected there, but it is a process which we will engage on very soon. Yeah, I think it's almost getting there in terms of the capacity one. And then the next one is talk to the expansion of the forensic DNA profile. Presently there is no expansion of profiles. Somebody had asked, I can't remember who it was, Chairperson, to say what do you have at the moment? Do you have a national forensic data, DNA database or something? We had responded to say we have a casework repository. Then the question was, what are you doing with the profiles already loaded in there? We are currently not expanding any of the profiles. The profiles that have been generated are on the casework repository are still in the casework repository. I think it will be important during the debate you also mentioned or to take a stand, what do we do with the current repository? Do we export to create a new database or to include all those that are currently existing? So that we are able to take the matter forth. It could be one of the issues that Nicolette was raising, one of the concerns that may not be, perhaps which are not necessarily formalized, to say what are you going to be doing with the current profiles that we've already generated. Will they by default be subject to the National Forensic DNA Database? The system evolution for the DNA interfaces and so forth, that with substituting through the SIU bus for automated updating of indices and expanding of profiles. One of the questions that Honorable Carola asked this morning was the linking of the interfaces between the DNA, between the databases. I read it between the databases. For the DNA databases, of course, the DNA database is not necessarily going to interface with other databases or other departments. The Chairperson has correctly said the DNA database will be housed in the forensics. But we do have information that is also needed to interface with other databases that are in SACS as well as in justice. This will now assist you with the expansion process. For example, when the court has decided in a finality on a matter, to say a person is guilty or not guilty and the conviction is pronounced, the system should be able to update it so that it's able to talk to us to say, this is a report, person X is on guilty as charged, and these are the terms so that you are able, you know, to update the records correctly within the database, remove perhaps person from one index of an RSD, place them on the convicted one, so those necessary processes can follow up. I think the question would have been, how far are you with trying to engage in those processes? I think your person will take note that there is an IDS board that also sits that also comes to Parliament, amongst others are those the interfaces that we are discussing with how they run those projects. I'm aware that one of the projects is about to finalize, they're in the pilot, but these are amongst other things that need to be finalized, expedited, expertise, so that we do not impact on the implementation process of the DNA database. Loading of sub-official, handling or examining of exhibits, suppliers and manufacturers and so forth. Just all the information of keeping, the updating of information in this access is very, very critical. It the information on the person who's completed the sentence, if a person has already finalized the jail term, or if a person is released on parole, you know, all the information from the Department of Corrections, from justice, from ourselves, we have to be getting it somehow through the interfaces of the system, so that their process is able to be finalized. We haven't costed this part, Chair. It's quite a technical part. We've been getting different values from the people that are doing the business analysis as yet. I'm sure they're still working on it, part of the IJS also, to know exactly what will be the final cost of this project. I know in this year it's 311 million that has been given for the IJS project, but it is not only focused on this particular aspect. There are projects within the IJS border that are taking key. If it can I be asked what was our anticipated value, we're thinking about 300 million given all the challenges in the IT infrastructure. But it is only based on what our current experiences are with the database in-house. It's a little difficult to quantify that process that will be the expansion. So, Chair, what I'm trying to say is, in your system, while we're working on the platform on implementation plan, which part would be problematic in effecting should this bill be passed? This is the part that will be quite too much of a challenge in terms of expansions, be it the DNA samples, be it the profiles. The DNA samples is in-house, it's operationalized, it's within our control. We may be able to do that within a prescribed frame. But the expansion ones, I suspect it's going to be a challenge depending on when the information reaches the office. Given the fact also that we have prescribed a time frame to say it is 3 months, it may happen that within 3 months we don't also have that information. It may happen that information reaches the authorized officer 3 years later or the person already had left. So we, somehow when we do the interfacing or with different departments, it is critical that CETA, DMS, all the involved departments really give into this, because it might just be first time offense in while the bill is passed. The next one talks to the integrity of the database. This will now refer to the implication in terms of the loss of information, damage to information, unauthorized destruction of information, unlawful access and unlawful processing of information. This will now talk to not only the physical infrastructure like the firewalls or access control or the vetting of members or implementing the MIFS or in the policy, but it goes beyond that process to go into the voting processes of our own members, our own staff. One of the questions that was posed by the chair previously, how secure our own members are, have they been vetted, have they been lifestyle audited, what are the chances that there will be unauthorized destruction or unauthorized access to information, should that happen, what are the penalties and so forth. What have we done currently? The members are currently in the process to be vetted, they completed the necessary forms. I think a few number of them have already gone through the interview processes, but that process has already kick-started in our current system. We are also already having started working on the firewalls and the control of the security access. Only new tech members are getting the access to that, to this environment there. But these costs for all the IT related issues include the discussions also with CETA. CETA currently has a number of challenges in that environment, CETA and TMS, you know, in terms of all the second service level agreements in this. But this is an issue that we may have to also seek some finality with CETA itself on how we handle some of the processes whose mandate resides just with them and not with that, to ensure that the accessibility of the databases is maintained as referred to in the Act. The next one, number six, is talking to the establishment of the oversight body or the oversight committee. This was also a very interesting discussion. I think, Chair, while we debated as well, there were instances to say, why wouldn't the human resource form part of the committee and not be called on ad hoc basis? Among others, you know, to say they are residents, there's other disciplines, they also form a permanent sitting in the while we're discussing this. But like we were discussing this morning, it may also be during the debate process to see, are they called on ad hoc? Should they really form a permanent sitting? Because if they've got to do with ethics, it may just by implication mean that they're also part of the formal sitting of the board, but not being called on ad hoc. Maybe other departments can be, but it's some matter of discussion that may come about. We have also made provision in the implementation plan during discussions also with the relevant department that they could in the meantime identify key people who will form part of their board. You know, although the chairpersonship office will be mandated by the minister according to what you've presented in there, but we've estimated the cost of running the board to be at R1 million. We do take note that the police people, the people in the Public Health Service Act may not be compensated according to the board functions, but maybe other delegates may be according to the legal advice. But we have estimated that the running cost would then go at about R1 million. The next one talks to the construction of the facilities for the division in Gauteng. Following the deliberations of the bill from the real onset, discussions around having the state of the art in Gauteng have been ongoing. How do you have one big lab in Western Cape and not one in forensics? The approval has been granted already. We are currently working on the process to identify suitable facilities which will accommodate then the forensics in one big area to also check the capacity that you are intending to house or that you anticipate with the passing of this bill. Currently, the accommodation requirements by the various environments have been identified that will include the DNA, including the DNA database, and then we the architectural plans and so forth, the process to get that finalized also on. This process is quite important when you take account of the archiving matters. How are you going to be storing the samples? Where are you going to be storing the exhibits? And how secure the area and all this kind of stuff. There should be facilities that will be adequate to be able to house the requirements in terms of the bill that will be passed. What is the current capacity we are able at the moment, the capacities that we receive to be able to accommodate these. But with the passing of the bill, we've been getting 80,000, anticipate 250,000. In a month or two, we will be running out of capacity. It may be quite detrimental, but we have made provisions for this. It is also difficult to estimate what is the anticipated building. With the inputs that you have given, Division Supply Chain has said it's minimum about 800 million. So I didn't place the values there as a team, but I thought that just should highlight what the initial inputs as we were discussing the new facilities in Gauteng that will house the forensics in the same time. This is in short, check what is contained. Of course, I didn't go through each of the bullet points. I take note that members may want to read it in themselves, but yes, we can take a question.
Members, questions? Honourable George.
Let me thank General Shizu for this presentation, but my worry from the very outset is that there are areas which have not been covered. And again, in the presentation, services no values, no cost. What is this? I hope by the time we finish the deal, those costs will be there. It was going to be very difficult to have an implementation plan and a signed plan.
At the bedding site, Chairperson, it's very important, because if we're going to have people who are not vetted at the forensics, then we will have a problem. So I think that should be done immediately. I don't know how and how they're going to do it, but it's just if we always have a problem in our departments too. In the cluster itself, but here it is very important that we have people that are being vetted. Thanks.
Members, I think once we've embarked on this issue, we knew that it's not going to be a cheap exercise, that it will be an expensive exercise. There's no question about it. There are two issues of concern to me, other than those that members have already raised. The one is the IT solution. And unfortunately, with our bad experience with CSM and CETA in this regard, and I do think that we need to have more clarity by the end of the process. So we are going to put pressure on the department to move on that part of it, so that when we pass the ball, we have more clarity on where are we going in terms of the IT process. And again, I see this issue of developing. I also again want to raise the issue that we've raised before. Look at already existing solutions as well. SAP's running into problems every time that it wants to develop something new. That's the one concern that I have. Second concern is the concern on your reliance on CJS funds. There's no guarantee that CJS funds is going to be there forever. In fact, we're getting to a point as legislatures where we are saying, what are we giving money to when you give money to the CJS fund, because we're not seeing the results. It's 12 years after the exercise. And you come here and you still tell us today, and I'm not blaming the forensic science laboratory, but that it might take you 3 years to know that the person have been found not guilty. Now, first thing that should have happened in the CJS revamp was the talking of systems to one another. And you know, that for us, I mean, we can cover it in the legislation by saying within 3 months after received of the notification. But that's not the solution. The solution is that these systems should start speaking to one another. And the millions and millions of rands that have hundreds of millions of rands, I mean, on the, which one is it, 500 million? On the e-docket system. We've already spent more than half a billion rand, and we have nothing to show for it. Absolutely zero to show for it. We've got 33 courts, we've got 60-something stations, but when you ask
none of justice nor such can tell you that those stations and those courts can actually speak to each other. So we really get to a point where we as legislators have got the responsibility to say we must relook CJR's funding. And I want to make sure that we also keep in mind that when we look at the implementation plan, that CJR's funding is not going to be an ad infinito source of income for SAPS. It's not going to be a source of revenue for SAPS. You might want to look at the possibility of starting to budget for all this from the SAPS budget. Because at any point in time, Treasury can say that we cut this off now. We've given you 12 years, we've given you 30 years, we've given you 15 years. This is it. It's not a source of income that will be there forever. But those two issues, I think, members, are together with the vetting issue, which I think the Forensic Science Laboratory themselves realize is an important issue. I do think we will, when we pass the legislation, or just before we pass the legislation, we need to get an update on the implementation plan so that we are clear in terms of certain things. And then we want you specifically to look and to comment on those issues that we've raised here now. We're not blaming the fact that it's expensive. We knew it was going to be expensive. But I think we need to be realistic in terms of where the money is going to come from and not rely on CJ's funding alone for this. It might be necessary in something else. Because is there any other questions on the implementation plan? If not, I do think I have spoken to the chair of Justice Committee. I'm going to ask again that the Secretary of the Committee follow up with the Secretary of the Justice Committee. I do think it's important that they send representatives to the public hearings that are starting next week, but also for the first few days of deliberation when we deal with the Criminal Procedure Act. So can you follow up on that? I do think, members, as a matter of courtesy at least, we need to inform the Committee on Correctional Services about this bill as well and the impact that it will have on correctional services. I will ask the committee secretary to draft a letter on behalf of myself, also to the chair of correctional services in that regard. Commissioner Jacobs, can I ask you just for clarity for members, is it possible that we can get a list of Schedule 1 offences so that we can just be at, you know, ourselves be informed what is Schedule 1 if offences and remind ourselves about those as well. If you can make that available for next week's meeting, it's fine.
Chair, I can just mention that I've taken all the parts of legislation like we've done in the past and put the amendments on that. And in that document, I've listed the Schedule 1 offences. So you're just finalising that document and it will be made available.
Okay, that will be great if we can, because I think it's important that we just remind ourselves as well what is Schedule 1 offences. Members, then next week we're starting Tuesday with public hearings. Members will receive the program, but also the public comments that have been made. The deadline was Friday. We haven't received that many submissions.
Where is the public hearing? It's London.
No, public hearing will be here. It's going to be with our people, Mr. George. we will start next Tuesday.
I am playing shepherd, so there is no people in this time.
No, there's a clan called George.
Okay.
We are starting on Tuesday. We have a flight for Wednesday as well. We have applied for Wednesday, we have applied for Thursday afternoon and for Friday morning. Now members, depending on how many, how long it takes, I would again provide members with the opportunity next week, Thursday, if I can just get the terrible twins to pay attention because I know already what they're complaining about on Friday. I will give members an opportunity, and once we've worked out the program, that in Thursday's meeting, that we rather carry on until 7:30 so that we don't have to meet on Friday. But we will only do that once we've worked out the program. So I know my customers and I know what they whispering about. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, it is a committee meet a day, but we are going to try and see whether we can't sit Thursday even for 2 hours rather than sit Friday morning. We'll also give the department a bit more
of an opportunity to work then on Friday before we start again. Deliberations then will start the week thereafter on the Tuesday. We will start with deliberations. Our aim is still to finish this bill before we rise, which gives us very little time, but we're not going to rush it. We're not going to rush it. We're going to take our time, but that is our aim. That is what we're working towards, so that when we get back, we can deal with the green paper and the subsect. Members, thank you very much, Department, Research Unit, Secretary. Thank you, everybody. Can I also say thanks to the journalists for presenting the tweets. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.